I'm Rebecca Roberts. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. It's time now for Tell Me More's weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arzalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Gustavo Arellano, who writes a column called Ask a Mexican for the OC Weekly in Orange County, California, and Matthew Continetti, an associate editor for the Weekly Standard Magazine. Jimmy, take it away.
Hey, thanks, Rebecca. Double R. What's good? It's your first time in.
Yeah, be easy on me.
Welcome
yeah,
to the
yeah, yeah. You ready? So wait. You ready to rock?
Of course. Born ready.
All right. Well, let's roll. But you know what? First off, I want to thank everybody. Welcome to the shop. What's up?
Hey.
What's up, man?
What's cracking?
Well, you know what? Happy anniversary. You know, a year ago today, President Obama held his now famous or maybe infamous beer summit at the White House. Now, he and Vice President Joe Biden threw back a brewski with Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates and Cambridge police sergeant James Crowley, Rebecca.
Yeah, well, of course, remember, it all started because Professor Gates, who's black, was arrested at his home for disorderly conduct by Sergeant Crowley, who is white. The charges were eventually dropped, but before all that happened, President Obama made comments critical of the Cambridge police, and so everybody was invited to sit down together. It's important to note, by the way, that the president and Professor Gates were previously acquainted, but that didn't really matter because the story ended up exploding with accusations of racist cops and racial profiling and suggestions that the president should just have steered clear of the whole thing. Here is what Sergeant Crowley had to say after the beer summit concluded.
I think what was accomplished was this was a positive step in moving forward as opposed to reliving the events of the past couple of weeks in an effort to move not just the city of Cambridge or two individuals past this event, but the whole country.
Wow. Mm. Thanks for that, Rebecca. You know, you say the fact that they know each other and that they're acquainted is incidental. But Maddie C, you know what? Me and Obama owes me money from that thing in the place at the time,
I'm surprised you haven't gone to the White House to ask him.
I'm saying he hasn't got me out of the ticket I just got. You know, for speeding. Maddie, what's up with that? What was it? I mean, it's a year later. Has anything changed?
Well, the beer summit's behind us. I mean, we have to understand why it happened, right? It happened because Obama went out of his way in his press conference to say that the Cambridge police acted stupidly. And that created a political firestorm for the White House. And this was right at the beginning of a summer in which Obama's approval ratings on a whole host of issues began to decline. So the White House felt they had to do something to address the damage done. And that was this beer summit. And I think if Obama had done another press conference, had the opportunity to do it again, he would never have been perceived to have taken sides in this conflict, which was a local police matter and didn't probably rise to the level of the president of the United States.
Gustavo, help me out, man. Are we post-racial yet? should President Obama take a definitive stance on race relations in America? What do you think, bro?
I don't know about definitive stance, although whenever he does see racial inequity out in this country, he should address it. And of course, even when he got elected and people started talking about post-racial society, of course not. I mean, the fact with the Girard episode and Andrew Breitbart, that shows that there is still a large segment of this of Americans who view racial conspiracies by minorities trying to take over good-minded white folks all the time. It's still happening there. We have to talk about race all the time. It's that and, of course, class conflict. Those are the two most taboo subjects. But race, I do think, is the most explosive one because nobody wants to be accused of racist, of being a racist. If you're accused of being a racist, that's almost a death knell to your public, to any public perception you have. But we have to have these conversations. We should be a more grown-up country. But I do think so many times we act like a bunch of kids in junior high, not elementary school, not high school, but junior high, when the rumors are the most insidious and the repercussions can be also the most dangerous.
Gustavo, tell us what you really think, bro.
My laugh said it all.
So shy.
A-Train.
Yeah, well, you know, being the civil rights attorney here in the barbershop, you know, I think it's important, to learn lessons from the whole Skip Gates incident. You know, for me, you know, last year when we talked about it on the barbershop, you know, I mentioned that, you know, if it was a white Harvard professor who was essentially, being asked to leave his own house so he could get the handcuffs slapped on him, I don't think that we would have, you know, ever seen it. I think that, you know, we had a case here where I do believe that, you know, Joe Crowley did act stupidly. You know, Barack Obama didn't go out of his way to say that he acted stupidly. He was asked a question point blank, and he answered honestly at the time. And it did create a political firestorm. But I think that, you know, here we had somebody who is the head of, you know, the African Center at Harvard University. This wasn't just a black professor. This was somebody at, you know, the elite institution in America, you know, who has, you know, spent the better part of his life and career, but, you know, talking about race, you know, being arrested in his own house.
I just want to make a transition here because, Arslan, you say if it was a white professor and a black cop, we mm-hmm. wouldn't have heard anything about it. But we have just seen Shirley Sherrod fired for what looked like racism against a white farmer without anyone watching the whole video, without anyone giving her the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
So we've just had reverse discrimination acted on with just the same amount of rush to judgment.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think that the whole Shirley Sherrod lawsuit now, you know, I hope she sues the drudge out of Breitbart for defamation, for false light, and all the other First Amendment tort claims, you know, that are going to be available to her. You know, a lot of people have heard about, you know, defamation, you know, consisting of slander and libel, where, you know, slander is defamation by speaking and libel is defamation by the written word. Most people don't know about the tort of false light, where you can not only sue for defamation, but false light. You know, where somebody is being painted in a false light that would be embarrassing to the reasonable person. And so I think that Andrew Breitbart's going to have to pull out his checkbook and write a check to Shirley Sherrod soon.
You really think behind this announcement that she's going to sue Andrew Breitbart, you think she's going to prevail, bro? Really?
You know, it is a tough standard. You know, in the Watershed defamation Supreme Court case, the New York Times v. Sullivan, you know, public officials, when it comes to defamation, have to prove, quote, actual malice, which, you know, I think in this case, you know, I think Andrew Breitbart is basically, you know, constituted completely of malice. So, you know, that might be an easier threshold to prove. But legally speaking, it is a defamation is one of the harder torts to prove.
Yo, Double R, wait a second. For the people that, you know, maybe have been living up under a rock for the last week, why don't you fill in the blanks?
Right. So Shirley Sherrod, who became a household name last week from basic, you know, civil servant obscurity, she was forced to resign by the White House because Andrew Breitbart, this conservative blogger, had posted a video of her on his website. It was heavily edited, but the video that he posted seemed to suggest that she treated a white farmer differently because he was white. And then when you saw the whole video, she went on to make the point that she had learned from that experience and she went on to help that white farmer. So once the context was revealed, both President Obama and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack apologized and offered her a different job at the Agriculture Department within their Civil Rights Division. And just yesterday, President Obama said the media attention surrounding all of this was a bogus controversy. But Shirley Sherrod is certainly she hasn't filed suit, but she's certainly suggesting that she will sue Andrew Breitbart. This is a clip of her yesterday in San Diego, where she was a panelist at the National Association of Black Journalists, NABJ.
He had to know that he was targeting me. Now, whether he was also trying to target the NAACP, he had to know that he was targeting me. And at this point, you know, he hasn't apologized. I don't want it at this point. And he'll definitely hear from me.
Just to follow up on that, there have been reports that you are considering a lawsuit. Have you decided whether you're going to pursue that action?
I will definitely do it.
So you're
definitely going to sue? Yes.
You go, girl.
I'm confused why she's not suing the people who actually fired her for wrongful termination. Yeah, I think she would have better standing there than going after Andrew Breitbart. Because, I mean, we don't know the full details, whether he had the full video. I think there her case would probably be more would have more standing if it was revealed that Breitbart had the full video and knew that he was releasing a selected portion when he posted it on his website. If someone just handed him this video and then he released it, I'm not sure you could put win a suit on false light cases as the professor suggests or as the lawyer suggests.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Rebecca Roberts in for Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More's weekly visit to the barbershop. We're speaking with journalists Jimmy Israel, Arslan Iftikhar, Gustavo Arellano, and Matthew Continetti. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Rebecca. Listen, just one last check-in, Matt. Do you think she should have left well enough alone? You think she should just walk away and get on with the rest of her life?
No, I think she has a serious problem with the federal government, who wrongfully terminated her because they were panicking over racial politics. But we need to understand it was the government that fired her, and probably the Obama administration had a lot to do with it. You know, speaking to people who have a long time experience in government, A cabinet secretary probably doesn't have the leeway on his own to make this type of personnel decision. Let's not forget, it's hard to fire people from the federal government without having some counsel or notification from the White House first.
Well, but the Obama administration said that this was Tom Vilsack's decision. I mean, let's not forget.
Of course they're going to say that.
Hold on. She was Georgia State Director of Rural Development. She was a mid-level staffer at the state level. This is not somebody working in D.C. here. And so, you know, the cabinet – you know, secretary, you know, took the blame for it. And
that's precisely why it's difficult to hire civil service. And fire civil service employees as opposed to a political appointee where you would have much more leeway in the executive to say, sorry, it's just your time is up. But an actual civil service employee, much more difficult to hire and fire.
You know what? We're just going to have to watch this thing. Hold on. We're just going to have to watch this thing as it unfolds. We're going to have to move on for right now. Because, you know, the Obama administration is touting a victory this week by way of a federal judge who blocked portions of Arizona's controversial immigration enforcement law. Now, the law has been the center of the country's immigration debates for months now, Rebecca.
Yeah, Jimmy, it's part of the new law went into effect yesterday, but a federal judge blocked the most contentious portions of the law, portions that critics say would lead to racial profiling by police. Here's Arizona Governor Jan Brewer talking on CNN yesterday.
You know, we're a nation of laws. The bottom line is that, you know, I always try to relate it to that a country without borders is like a house without walls. It collapses. And I know that there are several people out there that want to discuss other issues, but we want our borders secured. And as the governor of the state of Arizona, I took an oath to uphold the laws and to protect the people of Arizona. And I'm going to be relentless in it.
Mm. Wowzers.
Yeah,
thanks
right.
For that. Gustavo.
Yeah, she's not relentless. If she was, she would have gone after Maricopa County Sheriff Jarpayo many, many times, who has violated the civil liberties of so many people in the Phoenix area, mm-hmm. and not just Mexicans and not just immigrants, mind you, African-Americans, white folks and the like. This isn't a victory. This is just we're spinning our wheels here. People are waiting to see what a judge is ultimately going to decide in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That could take months. I'm glad that it's the implementation of SB 1070, it hasn't been put totally into effect, but the law's still on the books. It's just we're just waiting right now. I'm glad that the Obama administration is pursuing one of many lawsuits. Obviously, the Obama administration suing, ACLU suing. The one thing I would hope is that all these different people, all these different parties who are going against SB 1070, that they would trade notes and try to get one big suit instead of having five or six different ones wind their ways through the court system.
Well, the funny thing is that Governor Jan Brewer, talks about being a nation of laws, but she herself doesn't know the Constitution, which says that it's the federal government's sole right to make and enforce immigration law. It is not the right of state police officers. You know, Judge Susan Bolton in the 10th District, blocked four major portions of the law. The first, the requirement that local police check a person's immigration status during a stop. Second, that legal residents, brown men like myself, have to carry our freedom papers. Number three, allow a section allowing officers to detain people if they think that they're deportable. And finally, she blocked a section that makes it a crime for illegal immigrants to solicit work in public places.
But she did not say Arizona didn't have a right to pass immigration law. I mean, she didn't say it was solely the jurisdiction of the federal government.
One of the major provisions that actually did go into effect is the fact that state law enforcement officials do have to collaborate and do have to, ally with federal immigration officers in terms of enforcing federal immigration laws. And so, the four key constitutional provisions in terms of what I predicted that this is going to go up to the Supreme Court a long time ago. And this is something that, I think we'll see get to the high court very soon.
Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the issue at stake is, do the states have the right to enforce federal laws? And the reason that it's become an issue is because the federal government isn't enforcing the laws to the extent that the people of Arizona and people throughout the country would like them to. I mean, the one court where the Obama administration, the ACLU, the government of Mexico, and all the other litigants in this case have already lost is the Court of Public Opinion. And I think there that does show a deep public concern about whether we are a government, a nation of laws, and whether those laws on the books that are on the books, on the federal books, actually have meaning.
I want to get to a very important thing that happened this week, which is the president appeared on ABC's The View. He visited with the ladies. In case you all missed it, here's a clip.
I got a pod though.
Now, can I ask you what's the first couple of songs on your iPod?
You name it. You name a song, I've got it. Whether it's I've got Jay-Z on there. I've got Frank Sinatra on there. I've got
Justin Bieber.
I've got Maria Callas on there. I do not have Justin Bieber.
Oi.
Yeah, Jimmy, what do you think about the precedent going on with Barbara Walters and Whoopi and the crew?
I think it's conduct unbecoming. You know, I think we get it. You're a regular guy. We got it. So we don't need to know. You know, people are out there, you know, can't find a job. You know, the jobs they have, they can't afford to go to a dentist. You know, you're telling us what's on the presidential iPod. I think it's a net loss is what I think. Sorry.
Do you think it helps the public perception that he's aloof and nerdy and an egghead?
No, I think he's trying to take some heat off, and I guess I respect that. But, I think, like, again, you know, so what? What's he going to be on 106 and Park on BET next? Nah, I'm good. I've seen enough
of
him.
Yeah, SportsCenter.
Yeah. I mean, I know he's a regular guy. I got it. So be a regular guy and get the economy together, bruh. Seriously.
That's Jimmy Israel, freelance journalist, author of the book The Denzel Principle. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. We also were joined by Gustavo Arellano. He's a syndicated columnist who writes the column Ask a Mexican for the OC Weekly. He joined us from member station KUCI in Orange County, California. Matthew Continetti, associate editor for the Weekly Standard and author of The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. And Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of themuslimguide.com and a legal fellow for the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. They were both with us here in our Washington studios. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is back to talk more on Monday.